Today on KPR Presents, the best new books by Kansans or about Kansas. I'm Kay McIntyre. Each year, the State Library of Kansas selects 15 books as Kansas Notable Winners. In the first of a two-part series, we'll hear from the 2017 Kansas Notable Authors, including fiction, nonfiction, poetry, young adult literature, and more. It's my favorite show of the year, a chance to read some good books, meet the authors, and give some books away. We'll start with Alex Grecian, the author of the Scotland Yard Murder Squad series. Lost and Gone Forever is the fifth in that series. Nice to see you again, Alex.
Nice to see you, Kay.
We first met Walter Day and Neville Hammersmith in The Yard, the first in the Murder Squad series. At that point, they were both detectives in the newly formed Scotland Yard. In this book, Walter Day is missing and Neville Hammersmith is off the force.
Yes, yes. He was fired for just being too Bruce Willis, basically.
So pick up the plot from there.
Well, in this book, Neville is off looking for Walter, who has been completely broken down and is an amnesiac in London, living on the streets. So there's sort of a couple of parallel plot lines that eventually come together with the search. And as usual, with my rambling books, there's several other plot lines going on at the same time, including a couple of bounty hunters who come to London who are also supposed to find Walter Day.
Hammersmith only has one real client, Claire Day, the wife of the missing detective Walter Day. Her role and presence in this book is really expanded. Talk to me about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, when I first started these books, you know, it's the series is about two white male detectives in Victorian England, which is great as a white male, you know, cutting your teeth, writing your first book. But as the series went along, I got more and more, I felt hemmed in. I like to see other viewpoints and learn about other viewpoints, and I wasn't getting that with my two detectives. There are a lot of books about detectives in Victorian England. So Claire got more and more interesting. The more I read about how women actually lived in Victorian England, the more fascinated I became and the bigger her character got. And she became kind of her own person and honestly a stand-in for me because she's an aspiring writer in this series. And so her terrible doggerel, her poems and things, I wrote all those and I had fun doing it. So yeah, she's sort of me back then. So it's really easy to expand her role.
You've also introduced some new characters. Neville Hammersmith has two employees, Eugenia Marillo and Hattie Pitt. Talk about how they bring a different perspective, and they also really challenge the role that women played back then.
Yeah, in this series, the goal was always to take modern sensibilities and put them in a foreign time and place, which, you know, is foreign to everyone because there's no one still alive who was alive in Victorian England. And Claire, being married and with her personality set in the first book, I had a little less wiggle room with her and the things I could do with her. So I wanted to bring in more women who had different points of view so I could get different slices of society back then. And Hattie is very much sort of a modern woman stuck in those times. And the goal for me is to eventually sort of spin her off into her own series. So
she's, I don't want to say an amateur detective, but she takes up some detective work on her own to help pay the bills at Neville's agency.
Right. I mean, she's a professional detective at this point because Neville is so sort of, absent-minded. He actually doesn't really pay much attention to gender roles in society, which also gave me a lot of leeway to sort of let women get away with more than they would have been able to back then. So she sort of takes over the agency while he's not even paying attention.
Can I get you to read an excerpt?
Okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and read a very brief an abridged chapter that I read on my book tour for this book. And it's about the arrival in England of a pair of bounty hunters who have come and they're charged with finding Walter Day and killing him if they find him. So they're dangerous people. A two-wheeler pulled up to the mouth of a narrow alley in Saffron Hill. Two people alighted, a man and a woman, both dressed head to foot in black. The man took a bag from the floor of the cab and tipped the driver, who sped away as fast as his horse could move. The couple in black stepped into the alley and walked slowly along, looking all round them at the stalls of stinking fish and yesterday's vegetables. The man held his elbow out to the woman, who slipped her arm in his. A pickpocket circled and came up behind them, but the man in black casually swung his bag without looking, and the pickpocket went down in a heap. They walked on as if they hadn't noticed him. The alley wandered on, and they followed it through the fog, their boot heels clacking on broken stones, awnings above them dripping on the woman's umbrella. They did not speak, nor did they look at each other, but they stopped together when they reached a small home with no garden and a stinking garbage pile against the front bricks. One shutter was painted with the notice, "Lodgings for Travelers." The man led the way to the front door and, without knocking, opened it for his companion. She nodded to him as she passed over the threshold. Inside, the place was small and damp and reeked of old sweat and gin. A tiny old woman came rushing from some back room to greet them. "You're in luck," she said. Her voice was thick with liquor. "I've two beds left."
"We'll take a room to ourselves," the man said.
"Oh, you'd be wanting a posher place than this, then. We goes by the mattress here, and you'll be furnishing yourselves when it comes to linens."
"A room," the man said again. His companion did not speak, nor did she look at the landlady. She stared straight ahead and worried her thumb along the handle of her umbrella.
"That had come dear, sir," the old woman said. "I can't be giving out a whole room to just two people, can I?"
Now that the matter had come down to money, the man seemed to relax. He smiled for the first time, and when he did, the landlady shivered. "We'll give you 40 a week for the room, 2 weeks in advance, and we'll take our meals elsewhere."
40? A week?
The old woman leaned toward him and shook her head.
"I hate to say it, I do, but you can get a better place than this for 40 a week, sir."
"Yes."
"Well, then I'll take your money. What name would you like on the register?"
"None."
"Gotta put something down for the inspectors."
"Very well. Put down Parker."
"Mr. and Mrs., then?"
"If it suits you."
"Give me an hour or so to clear out a room."
"Clear the mattresses off the beds, too, or the floor if there are no beds."
"We got proper beds here."
"Good. Send a boy round for new mattresses. Clean mattresses. We'll pay for those, too."
"New mattresses?"
"And linens. New, never used. Have them on the beds when we return."
"New mattresses, new linens, that'll cost, sir."
The man smiled again, and the old woman backed away from him. He reached into his pocket and drew out 3 coins. He took the landlady's hand, turned it over, and laid the coins on her palm. "I trust that will suffice." The old woman drew in a sharp breath through her nose and nodded. The man nodded in return.
"Never seen a lady wear a man's clothing before." The old lady jerked her thumb in the woman's direction. "Don't she talk?"
"Oh, you wouldn't want her to talk," the man said. "I'm the polite one." He took his companion's arm, and the two of them left the house without another word or a backward look. The man pulled the door quietly shut behind them. When she was sure they were gone, the old woman clutched her wrist where the man had touched her. It still felt icy cold.
That's Alex Gretian reading from Lost and Gone Forever. It's the 5th in his popular Scotland Yard Murder Squad series. Today on KPR Presents, we're talking to winners of the 2017 Kansas Notable Book Awards. Let's stay with another suspenseful story. Hurt People is the first book by Lawrence author Cody Smith. The year is 1988. The place, Leavenworth, Kansas.
It's about two kid brothers who live in Leavenworth, Kansas, which is a prison town, who they encounter a stranger at their apartment's pool, while at the same time a prisoner has just escaped from one of the local prisons. And that's the setup, and it sort of takes off from there.
The prison is everywhere in the book. The mom refers to their neighbors as the guard, the warden. You yourself grew up in Leavenworth. How close to home does this hit?
In terms of the way I describe it, the actual setting details, that's pretty close to the Leavenworth I remember. The mood that the book creates about Leavenworth is different. So growing up, I wasn't scared, as the kids, they're kind of scared, or at least there's this ominous feeling looming over everything that happens in the book. That wasn't my experience because it was the only town that I knew. I had never been outside of Leavenworth. I didn't know that it was sort of abnormal for a town to have so many prisons. So how the town is described, I think that's accurate to what I knew, but the mood is certainly a lot more intense, which helps for the book, I think.
Talk to me about the mood. Hurt People has a deeply creepy feel to it, even on the day-to-day normal interactions, when nothing disturbing is going on. You still have the feeling that something's not quite right.
Right. That's intentional, right? So part of it is a writing device to increase the tension, to pull the reader along, and also to sustain the mystery. So on the surface, you know, the book can be viewed as one about family, about the fracturing of a family, about brothers, about friendship and relationships. But there's always that mystery and tension looming throughout. And I think that helps pull the reader along in addition to the setting.
One of the themes that runs through the book is the relationship between the two brothers and how they navigate their relationship with their mom. They're constantly pushing the envelope. The older brother is constantly pushing the envelope, right, in terms of what can they get away with. They're left unsupervised for long periods of time. And there's a lot of exploration of their freedom, I guess, mm-hmm, is probably the best way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, it really helps that the book is set in the 80s. It feels kind of like an 80s and before thing, before what people call, you know, helicopter parenting, whatever you want to call it, maybe smart parenting. So they have the freedom to explore the world, to make both good and bad decisions, right? So I think we talked about the setting of Leavenworth itself, but also the time period of the piece is certainly essential.
I got about 30 pages into the story before I realized that the protagonist does not have a name. Why'd you do that?
I think initially I was putting it off. I didn't know what I wanted the name to be. And then the more I played with it, the more I liked it, basically. And so I think I like it for a few reasons. One of the main ones is I liked it. Intimacy it creates, not necessarily for the narrator himself, but how he refers to his brother. He always says, my brother, my brother, my brother, because in many ways he is very possessive of his brother, you know. And so when this stranger starts to intervene or intercede, he does not take that well, and thus begins that sort of fractured relationship. So I think it works really well for that. And maybe I just couldn't think of a good name. I don't know.
It also really adds to the sense that there's something a little creepy going on here, or that there's, sure, something a little unsettling, maybe is the better way to put it.
Right. Yeah. I like that you're using the word creepy so much. I never thought of it that way. I just say suspenseful.
But I totally thought of it as creepy.
Yeah, but creepy works. You know, whatever gets you to turn the page, that's fine. Yeah, I think so too. And maybe also it helps with like the universality of it. So the brothers could be any brothers, any kid brothers. We don't have to name them to understand who they are, what they want. And if you've had an older sibling, you probably can relate or identify some of the things that come up in the book.
Sure, that idea that your older sibling is exploring his or her freedom, mm-hmm, and as the younger sibling, you know that mom wouldn't like that. You're breaking the rules.
Right.
What do I do about that? I don't want to be a tattletale.
Yeah. You want to go along with them as they're basically entering this new world or this new stage of your life. I meant to say earlier, so when you're talking about how they have this exploration to sort of roam Leavenworth without that supervision, that's one of the strongest responses I've had, is like the people, readers get so mad at the parents because the boys are continually putting themselves into danger, or others are putting themselves into danger, and people are saying, where are their parents? Where are the parents? But I guess that's just part of the creepiness.
Cody, can I get you to read a passage from,
yeah,
it?
Sure. So I'm going to read a passage that's early on that's describing the setting of Leavenworth. So when I talk about the book at the Kansas Book Festival, I'm going to talk about how writing the setting not only helped me understand the characters and the story itself, but when I returned to Leavenworth and explored some of the settings that these scenes are based on, it also helped me understand the setting in a deeper way, which was really cool. I had like a different reaction going back to these places that I hadn't visited in quite some time. Okay. We were quiet the drive home. My brother rode up front in our minivan, a purple and gray Ford Aerostar. It was the last big purchase we made as a family. I sat in back in silence, staring out the window, imagining myself a serious thinker, but really I just watched the city pass by with no deep thoughts. We cut through the heart of downtown, which was designed to echo a time no one I knew could remember. The streets were narrow, built out of brick, and had names like Delaware and Cherokee, in honor of the people the settlers had captured and killed. They were dotted with the same old lights that first lit the city when it wasn't a city, when it was just a nice town growing fat with hope. On each side there were small-time shops and the occasional bank, and when the streets were empty like they were this morning, I liked to imagine them as the site of a showdown, an old western gunfight. I could almost see the old-time outlaws terrorizing the town until my dad rode in, the new sheriff, and put every trouble to bed. Once out of downtown, we drove past the city's park. It was windy and gray, and there were no kids playing. There were men in orange jumpsuits, however, prisoners, spearing trash as armed guards looked on. This sort of sight wasn't uncommon. Whenever we drove through the city, I couldn't count to 10 without seeing some sign of a prison. The big billboard at the end of the city that read, "Come do some time in Leavenworth." The guards in uniform who crawled out of their houses at all hours and unlocked their cars with countless keys attached to the hip. The teary-eyed out-of-towners who asked for directions to a given prison, where they would visit their locked-up loved ones. It was all part of where we lived. Still, common as it was, sometimes, if my brother and I had been bad that morning or the day before, our mother might slow the van down, point at the men in jumpsuits, and say something like, "See? That's why you do what I tell you. You don't want to end up like that, do you?" Today, she drove by without a word.
That's Hurt People by Cody Smith of Lawrence. Congratulations again on being named a Kansas Notable Author.
Thank you so much.
When you hear the term wild places, what do you think of? Unexplored mountains? The desert? You probably don't think of Kansas, but maybe you should. George Frazier of Lawrence is the author of The Last Wild Places of Kansas. Thanks for joining us, George.
Thank you for having me.
What is a wild place?
So that's a good question, and one that I asked myself when I was in graduate school here in Lawrence, because even though I was born in Kansas and I was in love with the American wilderness, and you know, I spent summers hiking in the West and doing things like that, I always thought of Kansas as a place to come back and study. But like a lot of other people, one day I woke up to the place around me and I said, wow, I would like to experience that feeling that I get looking for wilderness in the West right here in my home state. And that led me to the quest, and some of the answers are sort of difficult about what does wilderness mean in the context of a state like Kansas.
What does wilderness mean?
Well, we don't have any wildernesses like we have out West in terms of spatial extent, okay? So we don't have a Yosemite National Park or anything like that, but we do have wild places that mattered because Kansas played a significant role in the environmental history of this country, and people forget that here. And so to me, there are two things. First of all, what is a wild place? And second of all, how do you get to them? And let's take the second one first. Kansas is 98% privately owned. Think about that for a second. 98% of our lands are private property. I'm not saying that's a bad thing at all. And certainly in terms of the preservation of wild places, it's not, because our private landowners are the best stewards of our wild places because they have such a great connection to the land. But because the demographics of Kansas is changing, and because even though we think of ourselves as a rural people, now over 50% of Kansans live in just 5 urban counties. If you want to get out and experience, you know, the bioregions and the wild places around you, there's only 2% of public land, and it creates a frustrating impediment and a strange situation if you want to develop a sense of place. So in that context, I try to avoid using the term wilderness in Kansas. Instead, you know, a Chinese geographer has said that space plus culture equals place. And so I started just using this term wild place. And so to me, a wild place is a place that may have unusually high levels of biodiversity, unusual or threatened plant or animal species, exclamations of topography. But more than anything, these places, for some reason or another, they hold stories. So you might go and find, say, a spring in Chase County, and it's a really magnificent, pristine site with watercress and virgin prairie around it. And if you know, say, for example, your grandmother lived there, she may have stories about that place from when she was a girl. And it turns out that oftentimes there are even Native American stories that predate it. So these stories span generational and cultural boundaries. And it's fascinating. And there are so many places like that in Kansas, but they're not, for the most part, in our state parks or public reservoirs. Many are on private property, and many are in places that you wouldn't expect to look.
Two of the places that you explore are not out in the middle of nowhere. They're in suburban Kansas City. Take us there.
Yeah, so I grew up in Overland Park, and I was amazed to find that there are two springs, one in Kansas City, Kansas, and one in Johnson County, that have an association with Shawnee traditionalist leaders that are relatively unknown. And when I was growing up, completely unmarked. One of them is the grave of the Shawnee prophet at the White Feather Spring in the Argentine district of Kansas City, Kansas. So the Shawnee prophet was Tecumseh's brother, and together they led a pan-Indian confederacy to resist American settlement in their homelands in Ohio and Indiana. And eventually, skipping many of the details, you can read my book to find them, the prophet came to Kansas when the Shawnees moved to the Indian territory in Kansas. His name was Tenskwatawa, or the Shawnee prophet. And he set up his final sort of prophet's town above an ancient spring that we know has existed from the time of the Kansa and back hundreds and hundreds of years. In the 1930s, it was the only spot that didn't dry up during the Depression in that region, so people came and got water from it. And why did he pick this site above this beautiful spring? I don't know, but he did. And today you can amazingly go see the spring still running, and it's in a very settled part of Kansas City, Kansas. And the Eastern Shawnee tribe, I may have the details wrong, but some of the Shawnee groups now have purchased this land and are doing some work to kind of improve the site where the grave probably is. But you know, this is a place that's been there for a long time. Locals know about it, but I didn't. And it's a wild place because, you know, the Shawnees were associated with the site, and it's been there for hundreds of years, and it's amazing. It's perhaps the least wildernessy area in the whole book. But you can go then 27 miles away, and in southern Johnson County is another spring, and amazingly, it's associated with another Shawnee traditionalist, Black Bob. And a lot of people drive on Black Bob Road, and
sure,
they say, what the heck is that? Or maybe they don't even think about it. Turns out he led a very secretive clan of the Shawnees that kind of just wanted to keep to themselves and keep things going like they were before they were moved to the West. And when they were in Johnson County, the history's a little iffy here. They associated around this cave called the Black Bob Cave on private property. A huge spring runs out of the cave. It looks like the Ozarks when you're there. And it's almost impossible to believe that if you walk a few feet out, you're surrounded by these large Johnson County-type houses. And the history is fantastic and interesting around that cave. But it's just an example that if you know how to look, you can find wild places anywhere.
George, can I get you to read an excerpt from your book?
Oh, yeah. So this is at the end of a chapter where I talk about old growth forest and the amazing pecan grove at Fort Leavenworth Woods. Whether it fits our national self-image or not, much of American history is gathered in the grass, strewn haphazardly behind old barns and in fields, cached in undiscovered archaeological sites and ghost towns, and harbored in the little clumps of wilderness that still remain. Our American identity is an oil painting on a canvas of wilderness. The Fort Leavenworth Woods is still a remarkable wild place. The paths beneath these pecans were the first to feel the footsteps of Kansas explorers, yet they remain paths, not parking lots. The lives of the oldest trees span a mythic period of cultural and environmental change, no less than revolutionary when taken as a whole. The ground under the Fort Leavenworth Woods has harbored many lines that divided clashing forces. lines dividing civilization from Indian country, fading cultures like the Nez Perce and the Kansa from the onslaught of manifest destiny, lost species such as the Carolina parakeet from extinction, the abolitionist fervor of Leavenworth, Lawrence, and Free State Kansas from the stubborn clutches of slavery in Weston, ancient wild ecosystems from the rest of the mowed down, plowed under, railroaded, drywalled, urbanized, suburbanated lands that dominate Kansas today. A few trees at Fort Leavenworth and in the Cross Timbers are older than the entire written history of Kansas, born in a time when people still spoke languages that evolved to describe the landscape of prairie and forest and sky. Unlike the Wailing Wall or the Temple Mount or Vatican or Stonehenge, iconic monuments made from brick, stone, and timber, this forest is an actual living thing, although virtually unknown to most people who live near it. It remains a no man's land. For both sides of those dividing lines, I hope it stays that way.
That's George Frazier of Lawrence reading from The Last Wild Places of Kansas, Journeys into Hidden Landscapes. I'm Kay McIntyre. Today on KPR Presents, it's the 2017 Kansas Notable Books, the best new books by Kansans or about Kansas, selected by the State Library of Kansas. Kansas Notable authors will be honored at the Kansas Book Festival on Saturday, September 9th in Topeka. You can find out more about the festival on their Facebook page or at kansasbookfestival.com. We've got more Kansas Notable authors coming up. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Interpersonal Psychiatry. The Interpersonal Sober Active Community is a physically active community for people who are recovering from a substance use disorder and those who choose to live sober. More information at the Interpersonal Psychiatry Facebook page.
Judith Fertig of Overland Park is the author of The Memory of Lemon. Judith, thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, it's great to be here, Kay.
Claire Neely Davis is a pastry chef who owns a bakery called Rainbow Cake. Tell us about Claire and her unusual knack for helping people find just the right flavor.
Well, in researching the book, I was intrigued with the idea of synesthesia, and it's a brain configuration in which a lot of musicians have this, where they might hear music as color. And I thought, well, if you're a pastry chef, what if you sensed feeling as flavor? And, you know, just like when a song comes on the radio and you have that feeling that you were back in junior high and your first love, you know, the feeling is the hyperlink to a story. So she's able to kind of sit with somebody. She gets a flavor in her mind. She can sort of taste it. That's the link to the feeling that someone has. And that's the entree to the story that they have that she needs to help them with.
Much of Neely's job isn't just baking. It's juggling the conflicting ideas that brides and their mothers have about what makes the perfect wedding.
Well, it's innate conflict. And so that's always kind of fun to see and how this gets resolved. And I think if you've ever been involved in planning a wedding, that there's plenty of drama that just comes out of the blue. Although my own daughter's wedding, I think, was a very fun thing to plan. But it's not always that way. You know, you have to, in this case, the mother has very strong, wants a wedding a certain way, and her daughter wants something completely different. And so finding that common ground where it's still going to be beautiful and lovely and meaningful is part of Neely's job.
Judith, you come by your knowledge of baking and food quite honestly as the author of several cookbooks. You write about food and you describe yourself as a self-proclaimed barbecue queen. Tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Well, I started off as a, this is how high school English teachers go astray. And and then I taught at the college level, and then when I was married, we moved around a lot, and I had to have a portable career, and so writing was the thing. So then I really enjoyed that, and then you have to specialize in something, so I specialized in food. After writing about food for a long time, I thought, well, what is the next frontier for me? What is going to keep me interested in this? And I thought, what flavor does inside your brain? What flavor does, what meaning does that have? What How does that make you feel? And so the best way to do that was in fiction, which as an English major, I had always wanted to do anyway. And so that's how that all came together. It just sort of evolved from what I had done before. With writing a cookbook, you're not letting yourself go. You're staying to task, and you're writing specific instructions, and you're testing recipes. Your kitchen stays a lot cleaner when you write a novel than when you do a cookbook.
Could I get you to read an excerpt from The Memory of Lemon?
Sure. This is from the end of the novel, but it's not a spoiler alert. And this is after the contentious wedding has drawn to a very satisfying close. So she's in the cabin, and she wakes up in the middle of the night, and she wraps herself up in a quilt and comes downstairs. I actually stayed in the cabin where this was set in Kentucky with the axe marks on the logs. I imagined what the scene was going to be like, but I will start with this. I had started the day with a homeless father whose reasons for leaving our family had been a mystery, and a grandmother so lost in the fog of dementia that she couldn't tell me more. Now I had seen. As I let the stories wash through me, I began to understand. All the difficulties with this, quote, hillbilly wedding had been necessary to get me to this place so I could connect with the past I didn't realize I had. It was up to me to find a way forward. The memory of Lemon had given me clarity. Such sadness, such loss, but such love. That was what remained. Love was the current that ran through every story. I wanted to read through time and space and tell my father that it was all about love. I sat back down in the rocker, feeling my body pulse with energy. Unlike the women who had lived in this cabin, I had no violin. I had no song to call my loved one to me, but I had the memory of Lemon, the flavor that would send the signal for me, a beacon of hope and comfort for my father. I held it on my tongue, in my mind, the flavor he would recognize as love. I closed my eyes and spread open my heart. I sent my dad a silent message. He was loved. It was safe to remember. The typhoon, the helicopter crash, the girl with blue hands, the little boy with a goat, the dark hut, the smell of urine, what happened in the deep and inky night that had swallowed him whole. It was time to bring that story out of the darkness, hold it up to the light, and come home.
That's The Memory of Lemon, read by Judith Fertig of Overland Park. Judith, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Kay.
Poets find their inspiration in many places: nature, love. Our next Kansas Notable author found his at McDonald's. Dennis Etzel is the author of Fast Food Sonnets, a collection of 47 poems all about fast food. Dennis, welcome to Kansas Public Radio.
Thank you, Kay. Thank you for having me.
Tell me the story of the inspiration for Fast Food Sonnets.
Right. So I worked at McDonald's very much in my informative years when I was 16, and then I left when I was 23. So I'd had several years, 7 years of working at McDonald's. And as a poet, you know, we do things as poets, like drawing on our experiences. You know, poetry I always feel is about the human experience, that it's more difficult to write about something that you don't know about than it is to write about something you do know about. And so actually the poems in this collection I had started back in 2003 when I was a student at Washburn, getting a second undergrad degree at Washburn. And those were some of the first poems were about the McDonald's experience, thinking about being at McDonald's and what it meant to work at McDonald's, as well as have this secret life of writing poetry. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to write the poetry about working at McDonald's. And so that's where these came from. And so I just had worked on them over the years, you know, writing here and there. And there's a publisher, his name's Brian Daldorf. He's also a teacher here at KU. And he has the Coal City Review Press. in Coal City Review, and I had always sent some of these McDonald's poems to Coal City Review, and he just loved them. He printed them and, you know, published them, and he really became kind of that cheerleader for this collection. And I thought, okay, I'm going to really try to work hard on getting writing more and more poems and finally get this book.
Well, they say write what you know.
Yes.
I'd like you to read several poems from your collection, but I want you to start with the very first one, Invocation.
Yeah, what a great way to do this, the poetic tradition of writing to the muse. Often the old Roman poets would say, "Oh, sing, muse." In this one, it starts with, well, I'll read this poem, Invocation. "Oh, sing, Ronald, clown with oversized hips, painted smile and floppy shoes that don't fit, through doors that continue to easily close. Oh, sing of your friends, the boy who takes after his father, the burglar, steal words, call on the mayor of verse with his head like a cheeseburger. Out, purple monster, named after his grimace, scare them witless, into a mixed bag, to go. I write, sit on a plastic bench, come close, I listen for your whisper, like static through drive-thru speakers, the strain of years I dig under. Evoke the name of Ray, a song to task, to sing out from a styrofoam casket."
I love that poem, Dennis. It's a perfect hearkening back, you're right, to the a song to the muse.
Thank you so much. I just wanted to really have fun with these poems. Definitely, I write about a lot of the things about the strife, about the struggle of working in fast food. There was a time in my life even where I was working at McDonald's, putting myself through school and college, and living out on my own. And so it really meant a really big struggle of like, and back then, you could put yourself through college working at McDonald's. Now, not so much because of the higher expenses. But it really meant a lot of the, you know, that struggle. Really, McDonald's was kind of my number one food source. So,
well, your poems are like that one, both very humorous and yet they do talk about the struggle. And there's a little touch of anger in some of them about some of the frustrations that that people have working in the fast food industry or in any industry where it's a minimum wage job. Can you share another poem or two with us?
Sure. I'll actually share one about that, about the frustration of kind of working, because when you are, I mean, you are wanting to make a better life for yourself, but also that is, you know, you're working, you have a job. So this one's called Closing the Store on Summer Nights. The closing hour turns to cleaning, turns to leaving at 2 a.m, as night employees stretch out on the grass beside their parked cars, as the automatic lights shut off, like they are told to do, commands given by the manager. Each face turns to the stars, those wishes to find a way out of this job. The hands that touched burgers, to wrap in wrappers, fixed cold drinks, now smell of grease and French fries, now dig to replace those gross scents with grass and flower petals, fingers pushing deeper into the earth. So I really wanted that, really, I love that earthy image. Now that I even think of that, some of the things that grow, like the, you know, the potatoes for French fries come from the earth. Hey, I think that's another poem coming, so.
Get out your pen.
Right. And, you know, that's the thing I love about poetry is the ability to express these things and placing these images together in a way that you wouldn't normally think about, that you're going into a place of memory and trying to figure out what's there that you can pull back out. So,
When you were working at McDonald's way back when, did you ever share any of your poems with your coworkers?
Oh, no, I didn't. I did not. I do believe they knew I was going to college, and there were two other managers who were also going to college, and they knew I was... Well, I was going into computer programming in those days, so. But the poetry part was really a hidden part of my life, and it was actually a part of trying to learn how to become a better writer. I was given the advice to keep a journal, and then those journals became poems. So, it was really kind of a hidden part of who I was, and It just takes, I think a lot of people are that way. I've always heard from others that, well, I write poems, but I don't really show them to others. And then that's kind of, I encourage them, well, start sharing with somebody, really, because it is. That's, I think, becoming a better poet is also being able to let go of those poems into the world of others. And then when you let go, it creates that space to write even more poems. So,
having said that, could you let go of another one of those poems for
us? Sure. Okay, this is another humorous poem. And it's about when you're basically in trouble by a manager if you're working at McDonald's and they decide to put you on the French fry station. That's when you know you've really done something wrong if you have to work the French fry station for an entire shift. So this is for all those fast food employees who have to work the French fry station. It's called Small Fry. As punishment, after being called out as lazy, you were placed on the station for bagging French fries, knowing anyone can pick up the handle, place containers on the end, and with a flip of the wrist, send the scooped fries falling down off the pile. Think of how the sun feels outside compared to the heat lamps reflecting off the back mirror, how the beach feels as salt gets stuck under your nails with the frying oil. People come in and check you out, looking hot in your uniform, as if glowing from the fluorescent rays, with the power to make many servings just by request.
Dennis Etzel is the author of Fast Food Sonnets. Dennis, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much, Kay. It was great to speak with you.
If you're just joining us, today on KPR Presents, it's the Kansas Notable Books 2017. We're visiting with many of the Kansas Notable authors, including Robert Krenzel of Shawnee. He's the author of A Nest of Hornets. Bob, thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, it's great to be here.
A Nest of Hornets is the third in the Gideon Hawk trilogy. Tell me about the protagonist, Gideon Hawk. Who is he and what do we need to know about him?
The most important thing to remember is that Gideon Hawk is an ordinary young man living in extraordinary times. When we met him in the first book, he was 15 going on 16, living in Lexington, Massachusetts, and he was struggling with a lot of the issues that young men that age struggle with. He was an orphan. He's being raised by his uncle, who's his guardian, and his uncle has some pretty specific ideas about what Gideon should do with his life. And Gideon's not certain that he's on board with that plan. So he's trying to figure out, who he is, what he wants to do. And he's starting to struggle with, who he loves. All that changes on April 19, 1775, when the British march through Lexington on their way to Concord. Gideon is caught up in the fighting on Lexington Common, and he decides to take up his late father's rifle and join the fight against the crown. And he becomes one of the small corps of soldiers who stay with the colors through thick and thin.
So by this third book in the trilogy, A Nest of Hornets, he's really in the thick of it. Tell us a little bit about the plot of this story.
Well, it's set in the winter of 1777. It is right after the American victories at Trenton and Princeton. So from a historical perspective, the British have sort of withdrawn from New Jersey into a couple of small enclaves. And in New Jersey and New York, and they have this huge supply line across the Atlantic that is incapable of feeding all the mouths they have to feed, both, men, women, children, and horses. So they have to go out into the New Jersey countryside to forage for supplies. And the New Jersey militia and the Continental Army are feeling pretty good about themselves, and they are not going to let the British go unchallenged. So throughout that winter, there's almost constant fighting as the British go out to get supplies, and they're constantly under attack by the militia and the Continental Army. One British officer at the time described a foray into the New Jersey countryside as walking into a nest of hornets, hence the title.
Bob, you are yourself a retired Army officer and a veteran of Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Balkans. What did your own military experience bring to the writing of this story?
I think that we're all products of our experiences. And for pretty much my entire adult life, minus the last couple of years. I was a soldier, and so I've been around a lot of soldiers. And I had the opportunity to work with some really amazing people, both in and out of uniform, from a number of different countries. I spent pretty considerable time with British soldiers and with German soldiers. So in my series, the folks that Gideon's fighting against, so I can I think I can understand them a little bit better. I've fought in wars that were far from home, that weren't necessarily that popular, against folks who didn't play by the rules. So I can sort of see it from the British point of view. But I think that, you know, the thing that I care about the most with this is that, I don't want to glorify war, because I've seen it. I've seen the after effects. You know, that's not what this is about. There's a cost. So, ideally for me, when a young man or woman picks up this book and reads about it, they think a little bit about the cost of war. I do think that there are some things that are worth fighting for. And I think that this, I like to think that if I was around at that time, I would have, you know, I would have been in the ranks with Gideon. But that's very important to me. I also try to bring out the toll that the war takes on the individual. I know a lot of folks, myself included, who suffer from post-traumatic stress, and Gideon suffers from post-traumatic stress. You know, there's some debate in the literature about whether or not that was a thing back then. They were human. It took a toll, and I think that it just manifested itself in ways that were different then. It wasn't recognized as such, but if you read the entire, all the stories, you will see that over time, Gideon takes a toll. He doesn't sleep as well. He's more irritable. There's a number of manifestations, and it starts to take a toll on his compatriots and on Ruth as well.
Bob Krenzel is the author of A Nest of Hornets. Bob, can I get you to read a passage from your book?
You certainly can. This is after Gideon's first experience with Lieutenant Colonel Dan Scott, who's an officer in the New Jersey militia. And at a skirmish near Millstone, New Jersey, at a place called Van Nest Mills, Gideon witnesses Lieutenant Colonel Scott basically execute a prisoner who was a New Jersey loyalist. Gideon is fairly shocked by this, and this is his... He's now gone back to camp, and he's meeting with Ruth Monroe, and he's sharing with her what happened. "It's been a rough few days. Care for a stroll?" Gideon asked. "Certainly. Would you like to talk about it?" The two walked slowly, side by side. "Where to start?" "I'm sure you heard about the scrap at the Millstone." "Yes, I assumed you were in the middle of that." "We were definitely in the middle of it. Everything went right. We snuck around the flank and caught them by surprise. My lads hardly fired. The militia did most of the dirty work. In fact, it got very, very dirty."
"How so?"
"Johnston and Jones took a prisoner, a New Jersey loyalist, just a private, a few years older than me. The militia boys grabbed him from us and, well, they killed him right there in front of me. It happened so fast, I couldn't stop it."
"That's horrible. Did you report it?" Ruth asked, clearly concerned.
"Report what?" "The man who shot him was a lieutenant colonel, a field officer. And it was only his men around. Who are they going to believe?"
"Not you, I suppose."
"Right," Gideon sighed. "Ruth, I've been fighting for a long time, and I've been pretty angry at the British, but I've never seen hatred like I saw by that mill. It was just awful." Gideon felt himself being overcome by emotion. He struggled to maintain control. Ruth placed her arm through Gideon's and rested her head on his shoulder. "That boy was so scared. He must have known what would happen if the militia got hold of him, but I had no idea. If I'd known..."
"You couldn't have stopped it," Ruth soothed.
"Maybe, maybe not. I just hope I never see that lieutenant colonel again."
That's Bob Krenzel of Shawnee, reading from A Nest of Hornets. It's the third book in his series of historical fiction featuring Gideon Hawk, a soldier in the American Revolution. Our last Kansas notable book for today is Ghost Sign, Poems from White Buffalo. It's a collection of verse from four poets, Adam Jameson, Melissa Fight Johnson, and J.T. Knoll, all of Pittsburgh, and Al Ortolani, formerly of Pittsburgh and now living in the Kansas City area. Al Ortolani stopped into the KPR studios to talk about their book. Let's start with the title, Ghost Sign, Poems from White Buffalo. What does that mean?
Well, many years ago, back in the early 80s, in fact, probably 1982, if I recall, J.T. Knoll and Don Bush opened a coffee shop in Pittsburgh in the old Hotel Stillwell. And the coffee shop was going to be a place for artists, musicians, poets, writers to come in, have coffee and talk, a place to meet. And it did just that. And the problem was it did just that. And the artists and the poets would come in and buy a cup of coffee and sit all day. And it was hard to pay the bills with only guys buying cups of coffee. JT and Don funded it for a long time. It was called the White Buffalo Cafe and Emporium. The business folded, but the idea of the White Buffalo, which was, we were told by that it was a sign of spirituality among Native Americans. I speak without any experience on that, just word of mouth, hearsay. But nonetheless, JT put together this group of sort of troubadours who would give poetry and sing songs, give readings around the area. And so he asked me to go with them. I think one of our first reads was probably up in Kansas City. I was not a part of the group at that point. And then after that, I was with them when we went to Joplin for a reading, and we just sort of, you know, melded. So we were called White Buffalo. The title of the book, Ghost Sign, is a reference to those signs that are on buildings that were painted in a bygone era that have all but faded away. And yet they're up there. You can still see them. And I really appreciate those store owners and business owners who keep the sign, you know, as a sort of archaeological evidence, if nothing else, that there were others before us. You know, we begin to see our connection to our ancestors, to the past. And I think that's special. And another interesting thing for JT and I, and probably the other two, although they're younger, JT and I can remember, for instance, when a lot of those businesses that are now depicted in ghost signs were once thriving. And so that, for us, that's sort of symbolic of our own, you know, passing time and our lives just slipping away, you know. And we wanted to hang on to that. So that became sort of the leading metaphor of the entire book.
Al, can I get you to read a couple of your poems from Ghost Sign?
All right. I don't know that this is the best poem in the group. It does tell a story, and it's about being a boy in 1961, and Kansas was having its centennial year. And so the grade schools were asked to do projects, and our class project was to, we had the teacher sort of said, go learn about Kansas, basically. I don't remember what we performed in front of the school, but I remember what all the kids did, some of the things, you know, from the various grades. And the neighbor lady took me, my neighbor lady, Joanne Schonk, took me and her son out into the graveyard, and we found the oldest grave in the cemetery, okay? So I call this poem Hunting the Oldest Grave in the Town Cemetery. Hunting the oldest grave in the town cemetery was acclaimed as one among many great history lessons completed by the third grade class during the Kansas Centennial. The class waded among headstones drowned in fescue and crawled below the junipers to etch newsprint with charcoal. Classmates visited the old fort and balanced on the ramparts, catching the faraway cries of stragglers from the skirmish on Cow Creek. Others, in tilling the garden, turned horseshoes between Tom's tomatoes, unearthing a bit more of the Iowa City blacksmith. North at the natural ford, some searched the unplowed pastures for buffalo wallows and military trail wagon ruts. The class dug a hole below the flagpole and planted a time capsule with their full names signed in pencil on a scroll of Big Chief. They would each be 109 when they dug it up, except for the new kid from Missouri who'd been held back a grade. He'd be 110. Yeah, most of that was pretty much happened. And I remember the teacher saying, now, in a hundred years, we will dig this up. And we're all going, how old will we be? She said, you'll be 109.
You'll be dead.
Wow, yeah. And that hit later. I was like, wow, 109. And then we kind of remembered the other guy. He'd be older than us. You know, it was one of those moments, you know.
Can I make a request?
Yeah.
How about another tornado warning?
You know, that's the one I opened to first. So here we are, just off of Tornado Alley. Maybe we're in it. You know, I don't know. But I've noticed that some Kansans don't scare easily with tornado warnings, okay? My mother and mother-in-law and father-in-law don't. And they simply get in the closet. I've seen Kansans when the storm sirens go off, instead of going to the basement, they go out in the porch. Where is it? What's coming? Okay. So this is another tornado warning, and I think you'll see that. Grandpa puts Grandma in the closet with a flashlight, a bottle of water, and a video poker game. By and by, he joins her, although he has to sit on a stepladder. He closes his eyes and listens to Larry the white cockapoo whimper below Grandma's chair. As the storm builds, Grandpa opens the closet door. The television casts a pale blue eye across the living room. Grandma sleeps, and Larry shivers with each roll of thunder. The St. Louis Cardinals are up by 2 runs, and Albert Pujols is stepping to the plate.
Can I get you to pick out a poem that is one not written by you?
Yeah, here's one by Melissa. It's about her husband, watching my husband cook. I apologize, Melissa, if I don't read this the way you would. Watching my husband cook. He moves down the length of the counter, a pianist scooting left on the bench to play the lower notes. 3 steady notches in the cutting board. A bag rustles. The fridge door opens and shuts. I offer to help. He answers no. He's the cook. I sit in the living room, write poetry, which is pretty and all, but we wouldn't starve without it. He caps a turret of steam with the pot's lid. He pours water and elicits the magician's puff of smoke.
That's Al Ortolani reading from Ghost Sign, Poems from White Buffalo. The White Buffalo poets and many of today's Kansas notable authors will be on hand for the Kansas Book Festival, Saturday, September 9th in Topeka. You can find out more at kansasbookfestival.com or on their Facebook page. We have several Kansas notable books to give away. If you'd like a chance to win, go to our website, kpr.ku.edu, under Extra Available Giveaways. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.